From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, building their demands, the UAW prepares for upcoming contract talks with automakers.
You know, I don't think there's right and wrong here. I understand where the UAW is coming from, and I completely understand where the management of the companies are coming from.
Marking the 150th birthday of the Detroit Public Library.
They didn't spare any expense building this temple of knowledge in the city's new cultural center.
How an act of civil disobedience in 1971 proved the FBI was trampling on constitutional rights.
I think it was because they were never caught, they were never found, that this story is not better known.
Plus, park a car on a frozen lake and start watching.
It's $5 for a guess, and you have to guess the month, the date, the hour, and the minute.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. The Detroit Public Library celebrates its 150th anniversary this week. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we'll take an architectural tour of its iconic main branch building. But first, the United Auto Workers Union is taking a big step this week to prepare for upcoming contract talks with automakers. Hundreds of delegates from more than 800 locals are meeting right now with top union leaders at Cobo Center in Detroit. It's the UAW Special Convention on Collective Bargaining. Detroit Free Press reporter Brent Snavely is covering this convention. He joins us now from Cobo. Brent, what have you heard so far?
What we've heard is pretty much what we expected we would hear, but sometimes, you know, just the idea of what you expect and then seeing it live are two different things. So as we expected, really the number one thing on the agenda of many delegates here today is the idea that they would like the leadership of the UAW to push for the elimination of the second-tier wage or the entry-level wage that automakers have. And if not the elimination, some have a more realistic view that they want to close the gap between the entry-level pay and the legacy wage that the older UAW auto workers make.
And boy, that's understandable. Your piece in Sunday's Free Press really hit me, where you report that FCA's Sergio Marchionne earned more than $38 million last year, and then one day later he got more than $21 million selling stock. And if you're on the line getting paid less than the legacy top tier one worker standing next to you, that really has got to rile you up.
Yeah, and you know, executive compensation in the U.S. and in this world is a huge topic, and those numbers are very much front and center on the minds of a lot of UAW members here today and on the UAW leadership. And in fact, Dennis Williams, the UAW president, he's actually going to speak and deliver a large speech tomorrow, we expect. But he's moderating today, and he did slip in one line today where he said when he thinks about bridging the gap, he doesn't just think about it in terms of bringing entry-level workers up to the higher level of pay. He thinks about it as, you know, in his mind, the disparity among all working people and wealthy CEOs in America.
Which would mean those top-tier legacy workers as well.
Yes.
Is there any talk of a third tier?
You know, I have seen some reports about that. It's been a pretty busy morning here this morning. There is some discussion about that, but the people I've spoken to think that a third tier is a fairly far-fetched idea. The UAW will fight very, very hard against any idea of introducing that.
Of course, at the same time, though, we know the automakers cannot let themselves fall back into the same habits that got them in trouble in the first place, and they have to stay competitive with those German and Japanese automakers that have lower labor costs at their plants. Is there any room for compromise here?
There's always room for compromise in bargaining negotiations, but you're exactly right. I mean, for all of the things that I just said, for all of the desire, you know, for wage increases among UAW members, the management of the automakers is going to argue exactly what you just said. Hey, look, you know, two out of the three went bankrupt in 2008, and four nearly went bankrupt. And healthy, wealthy labor contracts were only one factor that led down that disastrous road, but they were a factor. And so, you know, the automakers will not want to return to those days of irresponsible contracts that led to as much as a $30 gap between the labor costs of the Detroit automakers and their Asian rivals in the U.S. You know, that was just 7 to 10 years ago when the Detroit 3 faced that kind of a very uncompetitive labor cost gap in the U.S. And they will not want to go back to that. And the way to do that can be in one-time bonuses, profit sharing, some things like that prevents the automakers from having permanent higher wages that they have to pay in the future.
It sure is a balancing act for President Dennis Williams and his team, knowing that, you know, the rank and file have these expectations, and then knowing labor unions in this country have seen their power weaken and half the states are right to work.
Exactly. And that's, to me, as a reporter, that's what I find fascinating about this whole thing is, you know, I don't think there's right and wrong here. I understand where the UAW is coming from, and I completely understand where the management of the companies are coming from. And where they wind up, probably somewhere in the middle, is always a really fascinating dance to watch how it plays out.
Free Press reporter Brent Snavely checking in from the UAW Special Convention on Collective Bargaining being held right now at Cobo Center. Brent, thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Let's head up to the UP. That's where the Rotary Club of Iron Mountain Kingsford had itself a dilemma. You want to raise money for all the good works you have planned for your community, but those tried-and-true fundraisers, the raffles, the baskets of cheer, the Saturday morning pancake breakfasts, well, they're kind of boring. But then my next guest realized they had something unique with which to work, an old flooded mine with ice that's a foot thick. Jeff DeRitter is with the Iron Mountain Rotary Club. Jeff, tell us about that old mine, the Chapin Mine.
I think it was worked out in the early 1920s. It was a shaft-type mine and somewhat of a pit, 300, 350 feet deep. And then, of course, as mining operations stopped, pumping operations stopped because a lot of shaft mines would tend to flood because of groundwater. So the pumping stopped, and you end up with the two lakes or ponds. Basically, to the residents now, that's the Chapin Pit. And it's right in downtown Iron Mountain. So, Cindy, back in the 1940s, I believe, one of the local clubs, I believe it was the Lions Club, they put a car out on the ice and had a lottery as to when it would sink. And I remember at the very end, which was in the late 50s, I remember looking at those, thinking, gee, how neat they were, because at that point I was starting to develop some male interest in cars. you know, but they didn't take them out. They let them sink. When they went down, down they went. They may have drained the gas and the oil and that sort of thing. I have no idea how that progressed.
So you found somebody that didn't want a car and said, hey, let's do this.
Yeah, matter of fact, first of all, we decided that we're going to do this. And then one of the club members more or less raised his hand, and he ended up with three cars in his driveway. And his dearest beloved said, get rid of one of them because we can't put them all in the garage. So he turned over his 1998 Saturn. So we turned the Saturn over to the local vocational school, and they're very kind people. One of the groups, the mechanic group, removed the engine, transmission, anything that had to do with fluids and things like that, radiator, gas tank, brake fluid. The body shop group painted it because the car was a dark gray and not very nice to look at. So
what did they paint it?
They painted it a bright screaming orange with racing stripes.
No one's going to miss that, are they, Jeff?
Yeah, that's right. It's very visible. And then they turned it over to the graphics department, and they put our Rotary sign on it and our Rotary symbol. And then all the kids signed their names on the roof and the hood and the trunk lid. And then they had a little contest among themselves to see how many kids would fit in a Saturn. So we put 13 students inside and two in the trunk.
Well, good way to get the kids involved so they feel a part of this.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly what we thought.
But now, unlike the old days when they would just let this thing sink into the pit, you can't do that these days. I'm sure there's permits and do's and don'ts.
Yeah, well, it's not that complicated just because it's a very limited waterway, and it's by city council decree. It's not permitted for recreational use. But the city council gave us permission to go ahead and do it again, and they thought it was a great idea. They were all smiley-faced. And then we had to get permission from the DEQ, and they told us what we had to do.
And what was that?
Well, basically, it was the removal of all the pollution-causing things on the car.
But you're going to pull it out of the water, aren't you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Another company donated 500 feet of 3/8 steel cable. We have it attached to the car. We lowered the car down one of the steep embankments using that cable attached to a front-end loader, so it could let it down slowly, and then we pushed it manually out into the middle of the ice area.
And then people get to place their bets and pay a little money. How much money are you hoping to raise, Jeff?
The prize is $1,000 for the first year. We have no idea what we're going to bring in. We've gotten a lot of coverage, and we've had calls from all over. People are asking us to send them the tickets. It's $5 for a guess, and you have to guess the month, the date, the hour, and the minute. And if nobody guesses the minute whoever is closest to it is going to be the winner. If there are two that are, let's say, 10 minutes either side of the sinking time, well, then we'll split the money. If there are three people who guess the exact minute, we'll split the money. We also have a live cam, so people can actually take a look every day. How's it doing? You know, is it sinking? Are we getting any soft spots in the ice? Does it look like, you know, that sort of thing.
And what is your bet? When do you think that old Saturn's going to sink?
Oh, I bet on May 6th is the date I put on so far, but I'm going to enter a few more times. The only thing is I'm going to have to put down my dog's name or something, because it wouldn't look very good if the chairman of this thing won the money. You know what I mean?
Well, you really did a bang-up job pulling so many members of the community together for this. That's what I'm hearing.
Well, it is, and believe it or not, we have such a wonderful time talking about this at Rotary meetings. I mean, there's such a closeness. You know, everybody is involved in some way or other. We have 15 canisters. There are 7-gallon steel pails. The ticket committee can go to the various stores and businesses where the canisters are located, and in local night spots, restaurants, taverns, places where people will gather well into the evening and betting against each other more or less by filling out the entry form and dropping their $5 per guest or 3 guesses for $10.
And Jeff, I'm betting the more beers, the better.
That's very good, Cindy. Very good.
Jeff DeRitter is the chairman of the Iron Mountain Kingsford Rotary Club, watching for that great big plunge and see when that car goes through the ice. Jeff, it was a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy. I really appreciate this.
Do you want to bet on how long it'll take that Saturn to sink to the bottom? Maybe win some cold hard cash? You can head over to RotaryIMK.org. RotaryIMK.org. All guesses have to be submitted before March 31st. Still to come, how an act of civil disobedience in 1971 proved the FBI was trampling on constitutional rights.
You know, this was the first time that FBI documents were seen in the public. They really cracked the wall of secrecy that existed around the FBI.
That's coming up this Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In Michigan, it is now the start of wildfire season. Most wildfires happen in Michigan in April, May, or June, so we're getting there. Dan Locks is the wildfire prevention specialist with the Department of Natural Resources. Dan, a typical year for wildfires in Michigan would see a few hundred fires. What do you think we'll see this year?
Well, right now we've lost our snow cover fairly early, so we've been running some fires now for about the last week and a half, 2 weeks. So we're a little bit ahead of schedule, and with our long-range forecast that we're getting from our folks at the National Weather Service, we're kind of looking to have maybe a little bit warmer, drier spring than it has been. So we're anticipating to have maybe, I'll say, a busier than last year, but more along the lines of a normal, if you average it out.
Dan, are there some regions of the state that have perhaps a higher risk than other areas? I mean, I've noted that West Michigan, it's drier than usual with no measurable rain or snow since March 3rd.
You know, this time of the year, you know, rain is always a factor in what we do. But the spring of the year, the rain isn't quite as critical as, you know, as you would see late summer when you really start getting into some real extreme drought conditions. Because the fuel types that we're talking about are our fine fuels, which, you know, your grass and leaves and stuff. I mean, we can have rain in the morning and still run fires that same day, you know, when the sun comes out and some wind gets behind it, because it'll dry it out that much quicker. So the fact that we haven't had rain yet, it's a concern for us, but not a real great concern, because the ground, for the most part, is still pretty damp.
What are the most important steps that the public can take to help you, well, prevent wildfires?
You know, the first thing the general public can do is just make sure that, you know, before they do any kind of open burning, that they're checking to make sure it's a day that burn permits are being issued. Then even if they are burning on a given day, they need to make sure that they're, number one, probably in attendance of that fire at all times. A lot of our fires are just escapes from, you know, a little debris pile burning. People go in the house, have lunch or something, a little wind gust comes up and kicks it out of their pile, where if they were right there on site, they could handle that before it became a problem. And then just making sure that when they're done for the day, they make sure that the fire's completely out, you know, never leave it for the night, assuming to burn down or whatever, because the conditions can change. You know, wind is the biggest factor. And the fact that we have the dry grass, that's what catches the quickest, you know, and it spreads real rapidly, too.
What's the worst wildfire you remember in Michigan?
A couple of years ago, I spent quite a bit of time on the Duck Lake fire up in the UP over by Newberry Way. That was 20-plus thousand acres, destroyed quite a few structures. Every one of them has its own little uniqueness to it, but that was a big one for size. We had several that have been real complicated ones to deal with, too. Maybe not quite as big, but just remote locations are hard to get to. Quite a range of them.
How prepared is the state for big fires like this 20,000-acre Duck Lake one you talked about?
We're pretty good shape, you know, for the big ones. It taps our resources pretty hard. I guess the biggest thing is, as long as we just have one of them at any given time, if we had more than one, then it would be a little bit more complicated. But we do have a lot of mutual aid agreements with our border states as well as national agreements. So, you know, if resources become scarce, we can bring in equipment, manpower, and air resources from out of state or even from Canada with some of the agreements that we have in place.
Well, here's hoping we don't need to rely on those mutual aid agreements and it will be a quiet year for wildfires in Michigan. Dan Locks is with the Department of Natural Resources, where he is the wildfire prevention specialist. Good to talk with you, Dan.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Here's a scenario for you to consider. You believe an agency of the government is breaking the law. What do you do? Protest? Do you make a huge step from nonviolent protest to nonviolent disruption? These are the kind of questions we're hearing today in connection with Edward Snowden, with Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. But in 1971, eight people took that step when they broke into an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania. The secret files they took and then released to reporters in Congress proved that the FBI had been trampling on the First Amendment rights of ordinary Americans. Their stories told in a compelling new film from director Johanna Hamilton called 1971.
They called themselves the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI.
Recent events have given more indication of the extent of government snooping on civilians.
Last month, more than 1,000 documents were stolen from the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania.
This is the first time these eight people are telling their story. Among the eight, a woman who grew up in West Michigan and her husband. Bonnie Raines and her husband, John Raines, are with us now from Philadelphia. And we're also happy to welcome director Johanna Hamilton, who joins us from New York. It's so good to have you all with us on Stateside.
Thank you very
Thanks
much.
Thanks for having us.
In your view, Johanna, how significant was the action of these eight people?
I think it was incredibly significant in ways that, to date, we haven't really fully appreciated. I mean, certainly the media break-in is mentioned in the history books of the FBI especially, but it's really telegraphed in one or two paragraphs. And the great joy of being able to tell this story was really being able to connect all the dots, the sort of to reveal the full impact of what these eight people did. You know, I think it was because they were never caught, they were never found, that this story is not better known. And so, again, it was just a great thrill to be able to finally tell this story.
Bonnie Raines, you grew up in Grand Rapids. What drew you into the anti-war movement?
Well, I guess you could say it began, my activism began with the civil rights movement. My husband and I were active when we were living in New York. And then when we moved to Philadelphia, we quickly became part of the anti-war protests that were going on and were so central in Philadelphia. And we became very active, particularly with part of the anti-war protests that was called the Draft Resistance Movement.
And John, your life as an activist, as Bonnie said, you were involved with the civil rights movement. You were actually a freedom rider?
Yes, that's right. I was arrested in Little Rock, Arkansas on July 10th, 1961.
And all of that before the anti-war movement, but more importantly, before you married and became parents of young children. So you really had so much at stake as you were following your consciousness into this anti-war movement.
Well, the war was horrific, and the draft was horrific, and we were determined to try to have our voices heard in Washington to bring that war to an end. But the voices in the peace movement were not listened to, and it was a very frustrating time for all of us.
We didn't want to do what we finally decided we had to do. And the reason we had to do it is because the people that we elected and sent to Washington were not doing their job. J. Edgar Hoover was not only the most feared man in Washington, he was the most popular man in Washington. And nobody in Washington was holding that man responsible or his very powerful institution. He was almost for five decades the head of the FBI. We've had nobody as powerful as that since that time. They would not do what we sent them to Washington to do. They would not hold J. Edgar Hoover and his FBI accountable. We had to do it, even though it put our own family in jeopardy, because if we did not do it, it was not going to get done.
And I'm wondering, where did the idea of breaking into that FBI office come from, and the idea of taking files?
The beginning of it was our involvement in the draft resistance movement, where groups of us would break into draft boards in the middle of the night and remove the paper files that were used to draft young men and destroy them and to try to disrupt the war machine. So a logical next step in terms of getting evidence and making a larger impact and getting the truth out was to consider targeting an FBI office. And we were quite sure we would find some very interesting and incriminating documents. And we did.
And you showed, Joanna, very skillfully how all of that built and the tension and even the fact that there were nine people and one dropped out. You did a really great job in showing the suspense that went into planning this break-in.
Well, thanks so much. I mean, yeah, it was quite remarkable. I mean, these people trained themselves for this, you know, this heist, essentially, you know, this one-night heist move. You know, I will say also, just to go back to the sort of import of what they did, you know, this was the first time that FBI documents were seen in the public. I mean, they, as you know, we have people who say in the film, historians say, you know, they really cracked the wall of secrecy that existed around the FBI. As John just mentioned, you know, Hoover was both feared and revered in Washington, and, you know, sort of in equal measures. And so, you know, really no one dared go up against him until the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI did. And this was, you know, the one action of the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI. But as it turned out, it was a very well-targeted action. And then, you know, once the heist and the mailing of the documents was complete, you know, they returned to their regular lives. You know, they didn't need accolades. It was really just an accident that really has brought their identities to light. I consider it a very happy accident, but the fact that, you know, John revealed himself to Betty, essentially, 20 years on, was a happy accident.
The night of the heist, what were your roles? Bonnie, what was your role?
We chose the night specifically because it was a huge world championship boxing match between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier. And we thought that people in the vicinity of the FBI office would be listening to the fight and perhaps wouldn't pay attention to other things going on around them. So my role on the night of the... I did not go into the office. Four of us went in with suitcases. I was in a car on a side street next to the building to block a police car if it came around, to pretend that my car had broken down, and I would prevent the police then from pulling around to the front of the building where our people were going to come out.
And as Joanna shows us, you also were Secret Squirrel. You went in there as cool as a cucumber and cased the joint beforehand. And I love the way, Joanna, you used an actress to show us what 29-year-old Bonnie did going in, pretending to interview the director. Bonnie, what was that like for you watching you all these years later doing that?
Oh, it was fun. I got a big kick out of it because I think, first of all, I was sure that bit of casing was the last piece of information that we needed in order to move ahead. So I felt very significantly important in making that happen. And I think a little bit of the actress came out in me, and I don't think I was nervous. And they were not suspicious at all, and I learned what I needed to learn about the lack of any security in the office.
I think that's very interesting and important. It was amazingly easy to break into that FBI office. And the reason is important because it's the arrogance of the FBI back then. It was impossible for J. Edgar Hoover or anybody else in that FBI to imagine that they would be the target of a surreptitious break-in at night and a removal of secret files. They were doing that all over the place to the war resistors and the dissenters. But it was beyond their imagination to think that the investigators would, in fact, become investigated. That's what the Citizens Commission did.
Mm. John, what did you do that night?
I was going crazy. I had the getaway car, and I was parked in the parking lot of Swarthmore College, which is only a few miles from Media, Pennsylvania. And the whole procedure was only supposed to take about an hour and a half. But unfortunately, our locksmith was not able to pick the lock and finally had to break the door down. The result of that was that finally Bonnie showed up with the suitcases, but only 2 hours after I had expected her to show up. So for 2 hours, I was having a nervous breakdown.
I can only imagine. So there you are, back at home base again, looking at these files. What was the impact as you started looking at those and realizing the kind of files you had taken and what it proved?
Well, we were fairly certain that we would find significant evidence because of all of the watching that was happening on college campuses, many of which are right in the Philadelphia area. So the agents were busy in surveillance on those campuses, and we thought that probably an office would have some documentation of all of that. And we also knew that the FBI was an enormous bureaucracy and that they probably kept records of everything. So we thought we would be quite lucky if we found what we had a hunch we would find.
I'm speaking with director Joanna Hamilton. Her film 1971 tells the story of 8 citizens who broke into an FBI office in Pennsylvania during the height of the anti-war movement and stole files, proving that the FBI had been trampling on constitutional rights of ordinary Americans. Among the 8 are my guest Bonnie Raines, who grew up in West Michigan, and her husband John Raines. Joanna, how do you show us the ultimate result of that heist for J. Edgar Hoover and for the FBI was?
Well, a severe embarrassment for Hoover, who died a year on. But the ultimate result really is, you know, this process of through investigative journalists like Betty Metzger and Carl Stern was the build-up to the Church Committee hearings in 1975, which was the first time that the U.S. Congress looked at the behavior of all the intelligence agencies, including the FBI, and ultimately that leads to the first set of guidelines governing the FBI's behavior.
And the FBI pulled out the stops to find out who stole those files. You show us that very clearly in the film 1971. Bonnie, was there a point in time when you and John felt, okay, we're not going to be arrested for this? This is all going to happen and we're not going to go to jail?
I don't suppose there was an exact point in time, but we did realize after 2 months or so went by, and we could be quite sure that no one in the group had leaked anything and that we had not left any physical evidence at the office, because we would have known about that very quickly. We began to think that perhaps they were looking at suspects in the wrong place, which was a group of draft resistors in Camden who were arrested breaking into a draft board in Camden, New Jersey. And they really, we began to realize that they felt that they would find the media burglars within that Camden group and not look in other directions.
John, was the reaction to what you and the other 7 did, was it what you had hoped for or even more than you had hoped for?
Oh, I think it was more than we had hoped for. We couldn't know that we would have the document that would lead eventually to the revelation of COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program, which was clearly involved in unconstitutional, in fact, illegal activity. When the Church Committee finally brought to the attention of the American public the violation of the Constitution that was going on by the FBI, that was wonderful. I mean, for the first time, a powerful, powerful agency in Washington, which was doing illegal and unconstitutional activities, was revealed to the American public. And the American public, thank God, were outraged.
Joanna Hamilton, what are you hoping that viewers in 2015 will take away from what you show us, what this group of young people did in 1971?
My hope really in telling the story for the first time is it'll deepen the meaning and impact of the actions taken by these 8, you know, very courageous citizens, in my view. Love them to think hard about the sort of relevance of nonviolent civil disobedience. You know, kind of remind people what it means to be an engaged citizen, what it means to be a patriot in the age of the Patriot Act.
Joanna Hamilton is the director of the documentary film 1971, telling the story of
eight people, including our guest, Bonnie Raines, and her husband, John Raines, who took the step of breaking into an FBI office and proving that the FBI had been trampling on the First Amendment rights of ordinary Americans. 1971 will be screening at Cinema Detroit March 27th through April 2nd. And you can order the DVD and learn more about the film by going to the website 1971film.com. Bonnie, John, Johanna, it was a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you
so much for having us.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is no exaggeration to say that the main branch of the Detroit Public Library is a gem, a 1921 building that's an architectural wonder. And as a library, it's a powerhouse, the fourth largest library in the nation with more than 7 million volumes. The Detroit Public Library turns 150 years old this week. Dan Austin of the Detroit Free Press and HistoricDetroit.org is back with us. Dan, the Detroit Public Library start goes back to what, the end of the Civil War?
Right. It opened up on March 25th, 1865. So that was, you know, mere days before the Civil War was winding down.
That is something. And there were pretty humble beginnings at that point, right? And I'm guessing at that point, literacy wasn't a real high priority for a lot of people in this small town of Detroit.
No, we were still a frontier town in 1865 by most accounts. The library opens up in the old state capitol because, like most great things in Michigan, it started in Detroit. But the city, you know, it was a small town, about 45,000 people. Therefore, the library could fit into a couple rooms in the old state capitol. Of course, Detroit had bigger plans in mind, and much like the city itself, the library would just grow exponentially.
I know ultimately the library moved to a location that some of us might remember at Gratiot and Farmer, a little triangle that when I was growing up, I remember just east of the downtown Hudson. So it moved to this location called Center Park, and it became known as Library Park.
Right. The state capitol just proved to be too small. You know, a couple of rooms might suffice for a small shanty town, but a bustling city needed something more substantial. You know, we won't bore the listeners with all of the lawsuits and everything else, but eventually they took this park right by where Hudson's and Crowley's, for that matter, would be built, and they put a library there. It's not the same one that we might remember. There is still a library branch there. But the first real library, I guess we can say, opened in downtown Detroit in 1877.
At that point, it was becoming more important to a city's identity to have a pretty darn good library, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, I don't know who you would attribute the quote to, but, you know, a city is as great as its library. And that pursuit of knowledge, knowledge is power, that kind of idea really started to root itself in the city as we became more of an industrial center, just a larger city in general. I mean, a lot of people don't realize just how quickly Detroit grew. We started 45,000 when the library opened in 1865. By 1880, when the first library opened, we were at 100,000. And then 20 years later, we were at 300,000. I mean, cities don't just grow like that anymore. And the more people that moved to the city, you know, we didn't have Netflix to watch. You know, we couldn't binge-watch Game of Thrones in 1880. We had to read. And so there was a big demand for this stuff. And the library started opening up branches about 1900. They had locations inside firehouses and schools and factories, hospitals, these little satellite locations to fulfill the need that Detroiters had for knowledge and for entertainment.
And then what brought the library north up Woodward to the present site of the main branch that's right across Woodward from the DIA?
The old library that was downtown, and we have pictures of it on historicdetroit.org, and it's actually in my second book, Forgotten Landmarks of Detroit, forgive the plug. But you really need to see pictures of it. It's a gorgeous building, but unfortunately, that small triangular plot of land you were talking about, it just was not big enough to build a new library that could fulfill the needs of Detroit. As the city was continuing to grow north up Woodward, you know, there were some rumblings about opening up a new museum, what would later become the Detroit Institute of Arts there on Woodward, just north of Warren. So there was this talk about creating a cultural center in the city dating way back to 1910, 1915, around there. So they bought the land and work got started in 1917 on this beautiful building that you're talking about. It would open in March of 1921. And it was designed by Cass Gilbert, who went on to design the United States Supreme Court building in Washington, the Woolworth building in New York, the James Scott Memorial Fountain on Belle Isle. They didn't spare any expense building this temple of knowledge in the city's new cultural center.
I'm talking with Dan Austin of the Detroit Free Press and HistoricDetroit.org as we look at the 150th birthday of the Detroit Public Library. And I want to talk now about this beautiful, beautiful main branch, this building that architect Cass Gilbert designed and opened in 1921. And I have to tell you, I grew up near 9 Mile and Woodward in Ferndale, and I still remember the rush of once I got to junior high school, I could take the bus down Woodward, and I can't tell you how many Saturdays that I spent at that main branch exploring books, checking out books, listening to records from all over the world, and walking up and down that grand staircase. And I think, honestly, Dan, that building did something in my mind that has made me love libraries and books to this day. Can you take us on a little architectural tour of this building?
Oh, man. Well, much like many of Detroit's architectural wonders, you kind of have to see them to believe them. But as you approach the Woodward entrance, the outside of the building is covered with the names of scholars and intellectuals, and that knowledge is power, beautiful classical style architecture. And when you walk into the door off Woodward there, you know, you're immediately above you, you have all these beautiful ceilings gilded like gold and blue, and it's beautiful. But if you walk up a staircase on your right there, you're in this area with beautiful painted ceilings, murals on the ceilings. I don't know whether words can do it justice.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying here, but yeah. I mean, it's just such a beautiful building. It really is a temple of knowledge. And if you haven't been, I mean, it puts a lot of our suburban libraries to shame, and it shows how important libraries, education, had always been in the city of Detroit. I know that sometimes, you know, we see literacy rates falling and some of the things. Detroit might not seem like the place to go. I mean, these buildings, even some of the branches themselves, were just absolutely gorgeous, designed by some of the top architects in the region, if not the country.
So we've seen this temple, as you say, this main branch. It has seen wars. It saw the Detroit riots. It's seen the ups and downs of Detroit's economy. What's its condition today, and what are its future prospects? We know a lot of the branches have had to be closed, but what about the prospects?
Right. It's going to be the lone survivor if it comes down to that. I mean, obviously, the city's had a lot of financial issues, and funding for the libraries has taken a cut as well. It's seen a lot of branches close. The building needs some TLC. I mean, you've had some water damage on that staircase. Some of the paint needs a little bit of a touch-up job, but the building is still gorgeous. It'll be here for generations to come. And you know, the Burton Historical Collection is also housed in the main branch of the Detroit Library. That's also celebrating a big anniversary this year. This is where I go all the time to find out the stuff that I tell your readers about, everything from blueprints of Michigan Central Station to diaries of the Detroit luminaries. I mean, they have so much stuff. So if you're at all interested in history, not just Detroit's history, but Michigan's history, the Burton Collection there is definitely worth checking out as well.
And I ought to ask you, Dan, how does one access that? Because my understanding is you can't just wander in and look.
Sure you can.
Ah.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a resident of Detroit, you can go in free anytime. If you live in a suburb, they want you to buy a day pass. But you just go in. They have card catalogs. Look up whatever topic you're researching. Give it to them. They'll go down to the basement, and they'll pull up whatever record. I mean, whether it's Silas Farmer's scrapbook or work by Charles Agri, an architect. You know, some of his files are there. I mean, anything you're looking for, they'll pull up, give you this folder. And then, well, you're going to lose a couple hours of your day just searching through all of the amazing things that they have to discover.
Yeah, you brought back memories of a lot of happy hours for me, I'll tell you that. Well, the 150th anniversary celebration happens Wednesday, March 25th, this Wednesday from 5 to 9 p.m. It's open to everyone, and it includes architectural tours. And as Dan said, if you have not walked up those stairs and seen that incredible main branch designed by architect Cass Gilbert, you need to do so. Dan Austin, Detroit Free Press and HistoricDetroit.org. As always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is the future.
You built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
It's alive!
It's the sound of science!
133 years ago this day, a young German physician stood up before the members of the Physiological Society of Berlin, and he announced he had found the cause of tuberculosis. Now, it is tough to overstate the importance of that day and what Dr. Robert Koch did for what we now call the specialty of infectious diseases. University of Michigan physician and medical historian Dr. Howard Markell is back with us again. Put this all into context for us, would you? How groundbreaking was Dr. Koch's research and discovery?
It moved the world. To begin with, tuberculosis was an extremely common disease then as now, but it was probably the leading cause of death of anyone between 20 and 50 years of age in 1882 when Koch made that discovery. It was also remarkable because no one knew what caused it. A lot of people thought, well, it's a hereditary disease because it tends to run in families. Well, if you think about how many people shared beds and slept in the same room, you can begin to get a sense of why it ran in families. But the idea that a tiny microbe could cause all this damage and devastation was truly, truly remarkable.
And when you say damage and devastation, we do tend to think of tuberculosis as something out of a Bronte novel, but it certainly was not glamorous or romantic, was it?
No, it's been romanticized quite a bit. You know, if you go to the opera house and you see La Traviata, there's the wonderful Violetta is singing about it, or La Boheme, or on and on and on. It is a disgusting, terrible, awful disease. It infects the lungs and many other organs of the body. It erodes the blood vessels in these various organs so you can cough up blood. You have fevers. You're sweaty. You are as sick as you can be with real tuberculosis.
Before Dr. Koch made this big announcement in 133 years ago today, he had been quite glued to his microscope throughout his career and was mocked for that, wasn't he?
Quite literally. He was a country doctor in Prussia. He had a small practice, and he divided his living room. Part of it was his examination room, and part was a little laboratory. And he ordered a special microscope from Berlin. Now, that was high-tech stuff back in 1880, or this was actually 1876. And he worked in a pastoral area where there was a lot of wool gathering, a lot of shepherds and sheep. And he worked on a disease that we now know today as anthrax. Now, anthrax is in spores. They're very hardy, and they last in the dirt for a long time. And sheep kind of roll around, and they get it in their wool. And so anthrax used to be known as the wool gatherer's disease because as they sheared the wool, they would infect their hands. And so that's called cutaneous anthrax, and it turns the skin black, hence anthracite, anthrax, coal. Now, if you inhale those spores, on the other hand, as we saw right after 9/11, inhalational anthrax will kill you. It'll make you very sick and will kill you. But he worked on this microbe, and it's a very large bacteria. It's very easy to work with. And he was the first scientist to say this particular bacteria causes this disease. So that's the beginning of germ theory. Now, Louis Pasteur, by the way, would argue that he developed it, but that's another story entirely.
Yes.
So that was 1876, and he was not given the job he wanted. He wanted to become a professor and have a laboratory. It took another 4 years before the city of Berlin made him the head of their Imperial Institute of Health.
So once he gets to Berlin, he has a good laboratory, he's got equipment, but he was working away at tuberculosis and didn't tell anyone.
Yeah, he had, you know, the Cadillac of labs and hot and cold running lab assistants and microscopes and you name it. And then he decided he was going to work on TB, but he was going to do it on his own. So he locked himself in his own lab for several weeks or months, working on this and that, figuring out how to grow it, because you have to culture tuberculosis, and that's not an easy task in and of itself. And then finally he emerged, you know, with this eureka-like moment, however you say eureka in German. He had discovered that the Mycobacterium tuberculosis is what the microbe is called. He discovered it and could prove that it would cause TB because he developed these postulates, Koch's postulates, that you not only had to recover the microbe from this sick or dying animal, you have to grow it. You then have to be able to inject it in another animal. That animal dies, and then you recover it again. So that was the way he could prove definitively this microscopic organism causes TB.
How was he received? Because we know 19th century medicine did not look kindly on outliers and forward-thinking people. We know that
still doesn't.
Think of the poor obstetrician who suggested, dared to suggest that doctors wash their hands between examining OB patients to cut childbed fever, and he was hounded out of the profession and died in an insane asylum in Vienna.
Yeah, that was Ignaz Semmelweis.
That's right. Yeah. So how was Dr. Koch treated with this?
Quite different. This is about 40 years later. The cutting edge scientists or the cutting edge doctors were very interested in germ theory, particularly because Louis Pasteur was also making some great discoveries in France. And so when Koch gave this talk, there was about 36 very famous doctors in the room. They said nothing. Their mouths just dropped to the floor. It was such an elegant and clear presentation that he had just proved it QED. And in fact, one member of the audience was a young physician named Paul Ehrlich. And he was a dermatologist. And back then, dermatologists also treated syphilis because syphilis has a great many skin manifestations. So dermatology departments were called departments of dermatology and syphilology. He was interested in that. In fact, Ehrlich later came up with the first cure for syphilis, Salvarsan 606. But besides that, he was so impressed by it, he went home and worked in his lab to come up with a new way of staining the tuberculosis germ. Now, staining it certain types of dyes and so on that these cells picked up was essential because otherwise you can't really see it under the microscope. And Ehrlich said this was the most important night of his life. He had never experienced anything like it before or since.
So Dr. Koch becomes a household name, as you say, world-shaking with this announcement. What did he do throughout the rest of his life?
Well, he did publish that a few weeks later, and it was headline news around the world. He just continued making great discoveries. A few years later, he discovered the cause of cholera, one of the great killers of the 19th century. He had many other trainees who really were a hall of fame of bacteriologists, and he made a few missteps. So in 1890, for example, he thought he had discovered the cure for tuberculosis. It's something called tuberculin. We now use it as a TB test.
The little bubble?
Yeah.
I remember getting that in
exactly.
grade school. We all
but
got
But he announced that you still get it every year, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And he announced that he had a cure for TB. Now, there was a man in the audience named Arthur Conan Doyle, who will be well remembered as the creator of Sherlock Holmes. He was a doctor and a medical journalist, and he took the train from Scotland all the way to Berlin. He got a gig writing about it, and he said, that doesn't look like a cure to me. It's probably just an immune reaction. And he reported that, and he was right, and later Koch had to recant that it's not really a cure. But other than that little misstep, he had a remarkable career, Robert Koch, and won the Nobel Prize in 1905. I said he fought bitterly with Louis Pasteur, who's the first, who's this, who's that. Koch won in a way because he outlived Louis Pasteur, and you cannot win the Nobel Prize if you're dead. So Koch lived long enough to win the Nobel Prize.
A fascinating story. University of Michigan medical historian Dr. Howard Markel on this, the 133rd anniversary of the discovery of the microbe that causes tuberculosis. Thank you so much, Doctor.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Today's engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Joe Lindstra, Annie Norris, Lindsay Scullin, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.